Well, greetings to everybody out there at TFMR. Hey, it is Friday. This is a Thursday conversation, as we call it, and we're recording it on Wednesday. So, you know, as per usual, I don't know if I'm coming or going. We're just trying to keep it together one day at a time here at TFMR. So, today is a special Thursday conversation posted on Friday in that I have been able to track down my old friend Alistair McLeod. Alistair, as many of you know, is a voice of reason, a solid researcher, vital to the precious metal sector. And I'm just so lucky to count him as a friend. He is the head of research at Gold Money. He's been writing insightful articles about the precious metals, the global economy, you name it, now for years. And it's great to get caught up with him because I got a couple of topics I want to discuss about some of the stuff he's written recently. Alistair, thank you for your time, my friend.
That's very much my pleasure, Craig.
All right, let's dive right in. Well, you know what? Before we do anything so that I don't forget, tell everybody in your own words about Gold Money and how things are going there these days.
Well, Gold Money is doing very, very well, which I would have thought you know, anybody would guess is the case, given that gold has now broken up above that sort of 1350 level, broken up by almost $200. And suddenly there's a lot of interest in gold and also silver now. So, yeah, we're seeing a lot of demand, and that's great. And I think the other thing is that Gold Money announced the other day that they're going to offer the option of paying dividends in gold. Now, that, I think, should make the stock a very, very interesting quantity over time, particularly as people begin to think, well, how am I going to get some gold? One way to do it might be to ensure that you pick up dividends from Gold Money.
And they say, you know, of course, gold's just a pet rock. It doesn't pay dividends, Alistair.
Well, you and I know that's nonsense. if you want to look at the pet rock, perhaps slightly with slightly less bias, you compare it to physical cash. So right. You know, if you've got a stack of $100 bills sitting there underneath your bed, gold pays about the same rate of interest as that.
Right, exactly. And that is a perfect segue to topic number one. Everybody will see on this podcast page links to the most recent, I don't know if they're the only two articles you've written recently, Alistair, but they're for this topic today, for this discussion today, they're what we want to cover. One that you wrote a couple of weeks back about your perception of the changing dynamics within the COMEX silver market. We'll get to that in a minute. But as we began discussing negative interest rates and yields on gold, that kind of thing, I think that's a perfect segue to talk about the first article listed here. You wrote, I think it was just last week or the week before, about negative interest rates. And Alistair, it just continues just to just go off the charts. We're now over $15 trillion in sovereign debt that has a negative yield. The entire curve in Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands, now negative. Curve is inverting here in the U.S. Alan Greenspan himself said this morning that the U.S. may soon see negative yields. Alistair, in your own words, tell us where you think this is headed and what it all means.
Well, it's headed that way because central bankers believe that interest is the cost of money. Austrian economists such as myself know that actually that's not true. What an interest rate is it's time preference. It's a reflection of time preference, the fact that we prefer as humans, the possession of something today as opposed to the promise of getting it at some stage in the future. That is what an interest rate reflects. It is not a cost of money. Now, obviously, if you're running a business and you're borrowing, then it is a cost, if you like, of doing business. But the origin of it actually is not cost. It is time preference. So I think that's the important point to understand. But as long as central bankers believe that interest is a cost of finance, a cost of borrowing money, a cost of capital, then obviously it makes sense for them to reduce that cost as much as they can within their power to, if you like, encourage people to borrow money to, you know, invest that money in production or whatever. So, you know, that is the difference, if you like, between how interest rates should be looked at and the way in which they're looked at by central banks. Now, assuming that I'm correct on that, and I'm pretty sure I am, then central banks have a model which basically says that, you know, for a given level of economic activity, the equilibrium rate of interest is whatever. If economic activity declines, then the model will tell them they've got to reduce interest rates. Now, there's no zero in this, as we've found with both the Bank of Japan and also the ECB, and slightly out of the headlines, the Swiss National Bank, and also the Danish Central Bank and the Swedish Central Bank, they have all imposed negative interest rates. So, you know, the fact that zero is a sort of is a line and, you know, is some sort of lower bound, as far as the central bankers are concerned, is not true. If the economy is sliding, then there is nothing to stop them reducing interest rates deep into negative territory. And if I can sort of just backtrack slightly, in my earlier articles, I have tried to get the message over that we have a combination of events facing the global economy today that we last saw in 1929 to 1932. And that is the combination of the peak of the credit cycle with trade protectionism. This last happened in 1929, and in October 1929, the Smoot-Hawley Act was passed by Congress, and that was at the end of October. Wall Street got wind of it, and during October 1929, the Dow fell by, I think, something like 35% top to bottom. That is an enormous, enormous reaction to something which we are beginning to see again today. And this time, the dynamics are different. Instead of Smoot-Hawley applying to all U.S. imports, President Trump has been selective so far insofar as he has imposed them on Chinese imports, and he has threatened the EU with similar tariffs, particularly Germany. The so this isn't as violent as Smoot-Hawley by any means, but what is more violent is the extent of the credit cycle. The credit cycle has seen the most enormous coordinated global monetary inflation in the name of keeping the show on the road. Mm-hmm. And it's that cycle that is coming to an end just at the time when President Trump is, you know, introduces trade protectionism, tariffs, and all the rest of it. The combined effect this time could be considerably worse than in 1929. At this stage, I think there's not enough evidence to say that it will be worse, but we can certainly see the prospects for the global economy being pretty dire, potentially, because of these two things coming together. Now, that being the case, you have to think how the central bank's going to deal with this. Even in the absence of the, if you like, systemic crisis that we're either threatened with or actually materializes in an economic slump, I think we'll find that the central banks will lower interest rates through the zero bound into deeply negative territory. And if we do get that credit, that systemic and credit crisis, which we are bound to get, then they will do that very, very rapidly as part of their mechanism of rescuing the banking system. And the other thing to bear in mind is that as far as the central bank is concerned, the one thing that must not be permitted to happen is the value of financial assets to collapse. So they will look at that when it comes to them judging what level of negative interest rates will be required. So you've got two reasons for it. The first is this sort of rather stupid idea that they can rescue the economy because they think that interest rates is a cost of money when in fact it's not. It's actually an expression of time preference. And this, and the second point about it is that they need to manage financial assets. We're talking about bonds, stocks, and all the rest of it, so that those financial assets on the balance sheets of the banking system do not crash. They need to keep those values up, which is an interesting change from the 1929-32 situation when prices actually collapsed. But that was because the dollar in particular was tied to gold.
And so, Alistair, it's hard to see a way out at least this time. You know, back in 2016 was the last time gold rallied 30%. And in July of 2016, we got this peak of about $10 trillion in negative yielding debt. And the U.S. 10-year note got down to levels that we haven't seen until now. And then all of a sudden, there seemed to be a pickup in hope and economic activity, and those negative yielding debt levels came down, and everybody thought, and you know, and gold came down as well. Is there any chance of that? I mean, I suppose there's always a chance of something like that happening again, but it seems more terminal at this point, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, what you have described, I think, very accurately, is that the final phase, if you like, the expansionary phase of the credit cycle. Now, it's been very muted this time round for the very simple reason that, you know, the underlying rate of price inflation in America is considerably greater than official statistics tell us. And so the transfer of wealth from the private sector, the producers in your economy, to government has actually been considerably more vicious than anybody really realizes or will admit to. So that has been the limitation. That's been the break, if you like, on how the economy develops. So what it's done is it's muted the expansionary phase of the credit cycle. You know, almost without noticing it in Germany, or which is actually been performing quite well, but other countries in the EU, you know, suddenly that cycle is now ended, and we're now down the slippery slope, which is going to take us into the crisis phase of the credit cycle. So, you know, in some countries, nobody's really noticed that there has been an expansionary phase. I mean, it's not like, you know, the roaring 20s or anything like that. It has been very, very subdued because the underlying dynamics have basically throttled it off at birth.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, Alistair, before we move on to the second topic, I mean, all of that stuff is obviously precious metal and physical gold positive. And I mean, we could dissect that all day. But in its simplest measure, we get back to the, you know, gold is a pet rock thing. And that the argument against it from traditional institutions and hedge funds and the like is that it just sits and collects dust. Doesn't pay a dividend. In fact, it has a negative return right out of the chute because you have to pay maybe 1% a year to store it. when now the banks are charging you 1% a year to store your cash, doesn't that eliminate finally the final hurdle for people wanting to own gold? And gosh, if we go from, you know, 0.5% total allocation to gold and the precious metals, I mean, to 1% or 2%, well, for crying out loud.
Absolutely. No, I agree with that entirely. I mean, certainly what you're describing is what has got to happen if we get deep negative interest rates. And that is some sort of disincentive has to be applied to stop banks' customers taking out physical cash and just putting it under the bed.
Right.
If you like, putting it pari passu with the pet rock idea. That will happen. Of that, I have no doubt.
Right.
The cost of owning gold and storing it in secure custody is not nearly as high as you've just suggested. I mean, you know, gold money uses vaults all around the world, and the charges vary from vault to vault. But you're looking at, you know, figures like between 10 and 20 basis points.
Right. Which
is hardly a cost, really. And it's particularly not a cost when you take into account that you're taking your money out of a bank and putting it into safe custody off anyone's balance sheet but your own, therefore not exposed to the systemic risk of the banking sector.
Yep.
So, you know, I think the attractions of gold, which is the basis of your point, I think are going to increase as a result of this, not just because of the interest rate scene, but because of the sheer instability that seems to be developing in the financial system.
Yeah, and you put all those things together, and then you combine it with, and we won't even need to, I guess we can kind of use this as a segue to the silver conversation, you combine it with the incredible leverage and hypothecation of every ounce of physical metal into all these alchemized form, you know, digital equivalents. You know, you suddenly get a demand for physical that overwhelms all that, and God only knows what happens next.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, we follow the ins and outs of COMEX and so on and so forth. But actually, COMEX is not the big market. It's the London bullion market, exactly. Which is the big market, the forward market. And that being OTC, over the counter, there is absolutely no, if you like, price relevant reporting on that, except, you know, sometime in the past. You know, we don't actually know what's going on half the time in these paper markets. And having said that, there is a fundamental point in this, and that is that they expand the apparent quantity of gold and silver in issue by purely being a synthetic equivalent. And I put the equivalent in inverted commas. So really, you know, if you've got, let's say, 1 ton of gold and 100 tons of paper, you are taking effectively 100 tons of potential demand for the physical stuff and stuffing it into paper.
Yeah.
And that basically, I think, has been the backbone of American policy towards gold, going all the way back to when, you know, the 1971 Nixon shock.
Precisely. And we've got that in those WikiLeaks cables as well, you know, the official communications about that. So what they intended to do, and for all intents and purposes, is alchemy. You get people to believe that this is actually gold when it's actually just a demand, you know, it's some sort of synthetic, as you call it, or digital gold, or, you know, a gold substitute, you know, oh, it's as good as gold. It's a, you know, it's an unallocated whatever. And again, you get this point where, and this is where negative interest rates tie in, because if you want the physical thing, because, you know, the war on cash, as you said, is coming. They're not going to want you to take cash out of the bank because they want to charge, you know, I'll charge you for it and all that stuff. Yep. You want the physical thing. The physical thing is what is the entire system is levered to. So anyway, back to then point number two, Alistair, and that is this article you wrote a couple of weeks ago, which really stirred a lot of attention. And I just would like you to describe it again in your own words. And that's about a shift that you perceive in COMEX positioning in digital silver. That got a lot of attention. And so please, that link is on this page as well. I want everybody to read it. But please, in your own words, tell us what that one meant as well.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I just noticed something very, very odd. And that is that the four largest traders on COMEX were net long of silver futures contracts, which in itself is extraordinary. But the next four, the next largest four, were actually short, as you would expect, and they were record short. Now, the situation has corrected slightly since then, but basically, the only way in which the four largest traders were net long was one of them must have been very long and the others short to that trader. And to get sort of confirmation of that, I looked at the figures for the managed money category and also the swaps. And I was getting sort of confirmation that this was the case, because we were seeing nothing extraordinary on that side. Now, I should add at this stage that the COMEX market is, I don't know, somewhere between a fifth and a tenth the size of the LBMA. So I think I put it in the article, you know, we're looking at the wagging tail of the dog and ignoring the dog, in any analysis we do on COMEX. So, you know, with that little sort of point, you know, sort of mentioned, I then remembered coming over to New York, where I was speaking at a conference. This, I think it was back in 2014, something like that, 13, 14, round about there. And I was, you know, there was all these stories about JP Morgan, you know, accumulating silver or shorting the market or whatever. It depended who you talked to. And yet their chief trader, who's called Blair, trying to remember her name.
Blythe
Masters. Thank you very much. You know, she had been on, I think it was CNBC or someone like that. And stated categorically, and this was, it looked to me that it was set up specifically to make this point, to refute all the accusations that were going around about JP Morgan. She said, JP Morgan do not take positions in the silver market. She said it quite categorically. Any positions they take are on behalf of their clients. Okay, so it's not JP Morgan principal, it's JP Morgan with a very, very large client. And it was sort of with that in my mind that at this conference, I went round and talked to quite a number of the silver miners who were, you know, had stands at this conference. I mean, they were looking for investors putting money into their mining operations. And I talked to them about this. I said, you know, tell me how do you get your silver out? What actually happens? And they all basically said the same thing. The man from Glencore would come along and he would give, an assessment of the value of the doré, which they'd produced on site. And on the basis of his assessment, the doré was then shipped off for refining and they'd get paid. Now, I didn't actually find out who paid them, but I think it's a fair guess that you've got Glencore working with JP Morgan, so that Glencore does the assessment, JP Morgan then pays the miners, you know, quite simple. Okay, the next question is, who is refining it? And it was quite clear at that time, you know, with the sort of, concerns in the West about pollution, because there's a pretty polluting process doing this refining, that it was China. China was definitely the cheapest. And furthermore, China controlled as a state all the refining capacity in China. And they were taking in substantial amounts of doré. Of that, there was no question at all. So this, to my mind, was the most likely whale, and that was a term I used, deliberately pinching the term, if you like, from another incident where JP Morgan were trading, right, unbeknown to them, right, in futures and, you know, OTCs and hitting the market and all the rest of it. So we had a, if you like, the client was a whale, that I could see. And it's actually quite hard to work out who that would be if it wasn't China. So I assumed from then on that China was certainly involved in this. And I further assumed, and I think this is a reasonable assumption, that the dealers in China, and we're really talking about in the People's Bank of China, it's the money side of it that we're talking about, not the physical at this stage. The physical has been delivered, that goes in for refining, and that is then, you know, sold on to the solar panel makers, whatever, whatever. But we're looking at the money side, and that the money side is all handled by the People's Bank of China. So the traders in the People's Bank of China, who are the customer, if you like, the client for JP Morgan, obviously discusses price strategy in the futures market and presumably the forward market in London with JP Morgan. That is the role of the broker. What you then rapidly move into is a situation where the price is effectively managed by JP Morgan on behalf of its client. Now, that is a normal broking activity if you've got a large enough client, I can tell you, because I've been a broker, not in that sphere, but, right, I can tell you that that is basically what a good broker does. So that's absolutely fine. I'm sort of satisfied that that roughly is what has been going on. But then there was a change in the situation, and this is what this chart of the four largest traders on COMEX indicated. And it was just literally 2 months after President Trump assumed executive office as president in America. There was a change in attitude. So you sort of sit there and think, and I'm speculating wildly on this, I'll be the first to admit it. But I sort of think, if I was China, you've got this new chap who's come in, nobody knows anything about him, he's making all sorts of extraordinary promises. This is, as far as we're concerned, an unstable position. And this is also happening at the same time as the global economy seems to be powering ahead. So what's this going to do with our price strategy with JP Morgan? And it could be that even the JP Morgan said, look, I think the days of controlling the price at a low level probably going to be over. And what I would suggest is that we use the current situation to gradually accumulate physical silver or positions in the market. Now, whether we're seeing a reflection of hedging, if you like, of having taken delivery in London of physical silver, it matters not. We're looking at the financial side. So one way and another, from the time when President Trump assumed office, the dynamics changed. And this again confirms to me that this is probably China, because the four largest traders were long of something like 12,000 contracts. Now, that's not a lot. But when you bear in mind that one of them is long and three of them are short, there's actually quite a big position there. And I sort of reckoned that it was probably about 40,000 contracts, which in very rough terms covers about 1 year's imports into China. So it seemed to me to fit quite well. The timing of the market, of this article was absolutely brilliant, I'm glad to say, because until then, the gold-silver ratio had basically been rising and rising and rising. It got up to something like 94, 95. When this article hit the street, suddenly there was interest in silver. Now, I would like to claim that I move markets, but realistically, I think it was a happy accident. So, but ever since then, silver has, begun to catch up a bit. It's still got a long way to go. I think the gold-silver ratio is about 87 at the moment or something like that. But it's, I think quite easily this could go down to 50. In other words, if you want to have a punt on precious metals, then silver is probably your choice. If you're looking to have money, an alternative money compared with, say, a fiat currency, then gold is probably your choice. So it's an interesting point, I think, in the whole of the evolution of this sort of price shift, which is going away from paper currencies into sound money.
So, Alistair, there's a lot to unpack there. And I'm sure people listening would like me to kind of say, I'm not so sure I agree with all of that. and I think that'd be a fun discussion to have sometime, a topic maybe for another day to kind of unpack it all and kind of, pick away at certain points and kind of get and elaborate further. But that's not what I wanted to do today. I wanted today to give you an airing of that point of view, because I think it's important for people to consider. They don't need to hear, a full-on debate about it. I just want them to hear it, because the implications, if you're correct, are rather significant. In our final minutes, explain the implications. I mean, if you're reading this correctly, what does it mean?
Well, I think probably we're going back to, if you like, the negative interest rate story, because, looking at the silver market, I think that there is big demand in there. There is quite a bit of liquidity in the sense that people do have silver stocks. I can't remember, but I think the figure in London, in the vaults in London, is something like 15,000 tons. Sure. I mean, it's some of that's in SLV and all the rest of it. I mean, this stuff is allocated mostly. But it's not, I think, the same as gold. Gold, there's so little physical around, and you got this mountain of derivatives on top. And just remember that the size of the market in COMEX is a fraction of the size in London. I mean, this is something which, if the price really motors, people are going to get hurt. And by people, I mean in the bullion bank community. So that, I think, is something that the central banks, I mean, certainly the Bank of England, will be looking at really very, very closely. And I suspect that also from the point of view of trying to do away with the rivalry of gold to the dollar, I think the Fed will be looking, and the U.S. Treasury will be looking at that quite closely as well.
You talk about the Bank of England looking at it closely. I just spoke with Andrew McGuire 2 weeks ago, who said he's working with that member of parliament in getting all of that written into the record about the derivative exposure, and now he's meeting with the Bank of England and the Treasury as a consultant. So they're already beginning that. But Alistair, at the end of the day, though, with silver, if you're reading it correctly, and J.P. Morgan works as broker for the Chinese, and price, as everyone can see on the chart over the last 5 years, have been wedged into a corner as China accumulates physical at low prices. If you're reading it correctly, and China is giving up on that and switching that strategy to instead being long, I would say that would lead to potential breakout, wouldn't you?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we're seeing a price breakout technically as we speak. I mean, I think once we clear the $17 level, that undoubtedly is what the technical analysts will tell us. But certainly, no, you are right. As far as China is concerned, I think they're in the position where they mine, I think, roughly half the, currently about half of what they require in terms of annual silver consumption. But they're going to want to build, I think, a greater level of stocks, if you like, as protection. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something which, you know, sort of people stopped doing. But back, if you went back into the sort of 60s and 70s, I mean, America had huge great stocks, you know, so six billion ounces of silver or whatever, and they would sit on it. You know, that nobody seems to do that anymore. But I think those times could well be coming back as far as China is concerned. They will need the opportunity to do it. And we don't know what their stocks are because obviously they don't tell us these things. But I would guess they've got quite a lot under their belt and would like more. Yep. But I think the real driver for the price, apart from that, I think is the fact that the amount of silver available for investment purposes, if I can put it that way, is actually a very small portion of the total. I don't know, 10% of annual mine output, something like that. So it is not going to take very much of a swing against paper currencies to get that gold-silver ratio down. And I think as an initial target to see it get down to 50, I think that's probably quite a reasonable objective. Mm. And you can calculate it out. I mean, I haven't done the calculation, but you can calculate where that takes gold and silver pretty much. I mean, whether it's driven by gold or whether it's driven by silver. I mean, it'll obviously be driven by gold more than silver. But that sort of level, I think, does give you know, someone who's looking at an investment opportunity a good speculative punt. But I would say that the way we look at gold very much is as money. Money is there not to be bought and sold at a profit, unless you're a foreign exchange dealer, of course, but it is there eventually to be spent. And so I think you accumulate gold against the day when paper currencies no longer exist, and you probably play the silver market, if you like, to maximize your returns.
Couldn't have said it better myself, my friend. I think this has been extraordinarily valuable for everybody to listen. I suspect some folks will go back and listen to it again, which they probably should, because this was some great stuff. Alistair, it has been too long since we last spoke. Let's make sure it's not that long before we speak again.
I would very much like that, Craig.
My friend, have a great weekend.
And you. Thanks.
And from everybody here at TFMR, we wish you all a great weekend. Come back next week and we'll see what the world has in store for us as we move into the last stages of August.